Thank you, Sanjay, very much. Thank you for your introduction and thank you for inviting me here. Je vais parler en anglais, mais je voudrais commencer avec une apologie parce que j'aurais bien plus aimé parler en français, mais je crois que mon français ne serait dans un bâtiment qui, dans une institution qui a été créée dans les mêmes années que l'édit de Villers-Cotterêts, ça créerait des problèmes. Donc, je garde de mes études en France des souvenirs parmi les plus beaux de ma vie. Mon français est devenu pire. C'est un grand honneur de toute manière d'être là j'espère d'apprendre aussi beaucoup aujourd'hui. I would like to start with a text that isn't a news medium, but captures what I see as the double dimension of the circulation of information. The beautifully titled, I hope you'll agree, the beautifully titled Sex Linguarum must have been the best-selling vocabulista or plurilingual dictionary of early modern Europe. It included Italian and German, Latin, French, English, and Spanish. Other different versions included Slovene, Czech, Polish, and Hungarian, and there were also Greek and Turkish variants too, as in this 1574 case that promises you that with this vocabulario nuovo, you can by yourself learn to speak or at least understand all these languages. These were small, presumably cheap books that sold well. Sex Linguarum alone had some 90 editions in a century. Partly, this is because they were aimed at everyday use and at a large public. The 1574 page, title page, shows a traveler with a staff and a bag, presumably, or perhaps, asking for directions in a foreign language. The preface of the 1563 Venetian edition, you see, described the Sex Linguarum as aimed at male apprentices going abroad, and interestingly, at female servants who went abroad to search for employment. The Sex Linguarum is no simple dictionary. The words are not listed alphabetically, but by themes, geography, body parts, animals, numbers, by situations, marketplace, aboard a ship, in the inn, and so on. The book also includes set phrases. How much does this cost? What is your best price? Do you have a room? And also, wonderfully, would you like to sleep with me? The last set phrase before the customary amen, which you see here, was the question, Che novella? What news? Was Neues? Quelle nouvelle? The dictionaries usefully remind us that information circulated on a double levels or regimes involving different media, actors, and settings. One regime required translation and writing because information traveled hundreds of miles across linguistic and political borders. The two are obviously not the same. This is an important point for the Connected History Project. Long-distance information was crucial in constituting a transcultural space for common knowledge, although it also, as we shall see, contributed to constructing boundaries and frontiers. The other regime was local. In the dictionary, set phrases like, what news, immediately preceded here by, tell me the truth, or other phrases like, in the square they are talking, and so on, of which the dictionaries are full. All these phrases alluded to and presumably facilitated an exchange of news that was essentially oral and face-to-face, highly localized and influenced by social relationships. It was an exchange that was socially determined, but not, as we shall see, socially specific. These two dimensions normally make for the subject matter of different fields. Historians of information study long-distance dissemination through written newsletters or printed gazettes. On the other hand, some urban and cultural historians study local communication. Instead, today, I would like to investigate the interactions between these two levels. This paper will be a back and forth, a va-et-vient between these two levels. A further connection I would like to make is that these interactions have to do not just with distribution and reception, more or less passive, but also with the production of news. When historians of information discuss circulation, they tend to think of diffusion, readership, the end point of a linear process. But information didn't move unchanged along a line from the event to the reader. And here I think that the reflections on the global circulation as a transformative, the global circulation as a transformative process, which Sanjay mentioned, discussed in his introduction, I think they're very, very important to me. So the circulation of information was itself a transformative process. The news were composed along their long distance movement because they were enriched locally at every stop. The interactions of local and long distance inform the shape of the most important medium for the distribution of news in the century between roughly 1550 and 1650, the manuscript newsletter. So the manuscript medium retained a crucial importance even in Europe, even in the age of the printing press. Manuscript newsletters had different names in different languages, avviso in Italian, avvi, avviso, report, current. I understand that they were called ahba, ahval, or efza in Turkish, but I would like to know more about this. Two main features marked out newsletters from earlier means of information. First, unlike personal and merchant letters, they were addressed not to personal acquaintances or business associates, but they were distributed commercially for a fee to networks of paying subscribers. Secondly, unlike occasional printed reports, newsletters were written on a regular basis. They didn't contain just one single story, but a variety of news. The news themselves were assembled by professionals in different locations who received other newsletters from other locations, which they collated in new sheets. For this reason, as you can see here, most newsletters had several headings indicating the source of a particular news story. This newsletter you see here was written in Venice and sent to a bookseller in Bologna. The first heading is dated from Antwerp, but it in turn contains news from Brussels and Amsterdam. This is sometimes misunderstood in the literature. For example, this diagram describes the accumulation of the Fugger newsletters, the Fugger family assembled one of the largest extant collections. It describes that collection as if one center in Augsburg collected information from a network of sources. But in fact, information moved through postal routes made of succession of centers. Indeed, an analogy can be made between the movement of newsletters and that of ships in the Mediterranean. Sailors avoided long voyages across the sea. They stopped along nearby ports to embark food and sell small amounts of goods. Even long-distance commerce functioned through a series of short stops. As has been argued, the Mediterranean was a space marked less by unity in Braudel's sense than by the density of connections. Rather than network diagrams, it might be more useful to juxtapose postal routes and avvisi. And just as the cargo of ships changed along the way, so newsletters were re-elaborated at every stop by local news writer. They selected some of the information they received and crucially interpreted that information in accordance with local circumstances. They also enriched their newsletters with local items which they gathered on site through a variety of other means: hearsay and conversation, print, public ceremonies, official declarations. In Rome, for example, news writers picked up information at the Banchi, in Milan, in the Broletto, and in Venice they went to a corner by Rialto in the morning and to the main post office near San Marco in the afternoon. More comparisons of this kind are needed, but this is clearly a history of localities at once connected and specific. What were the effects of this double circulation on the news? I will try to answer on the basis of two events, one very famous, the other virtually unknown. They are two naval battles. This is not because I want to resurrect some kind of histoire bataille, even though I think that Duby's lesson on Bouvines could still be developed, but because these naval battles are self-contained events taking place far away from news writers, who therefore had to rely on channels of information they couldn't completely control. By concentrating on case studies, I can study different sources and so capture the slant or spin of particular pieces of news for different people: news writers, readers, and simple speakers. On the first event, I can be brief, because it is already very famous. To traditional historians, the Battle of Lepanto of 7 October 1571 both encapsulates and culminates a history of the Mediterranean Sea as divided by religious conflict. Even Brodel insisted on the structural and conjunctural factors undermining the battle in the long term, but emphasized the psychological importance of the victory in Christian Europe. Crucial to this effect was the dissemination of information concerning the battle, another of his preoccupation. Now, this is a well-known story. The first ship reaching Venice with the news was a galley named Angel Gabriel, because the name of the owner, Angelo Gabriel, aptly coincided with that of the most important messenger in Christianity. Manuscript newsletters immediately echoed the message. This one was sent to the Fuggers in Augsburg on the same day. The newsletters fed a great number of printed reports, more than 200 in Italian alone. They were mostly cheap publications, a form of communication aimed at a mass public. They also interacted with a variety of other media and communicative situations, such as massive ceremonies of Thanksgiving. Great scholars, from Ernst Gombrich to Carlo Dionisotti, have studied the victory's celebration in art, literature, music, and ritual in Italy, Spain, and beyond. As they showed, the celebrations turned Lepanto into a symbol, a central element in a double ideological construct resting on the triumph of Christianity against the infidel and on the superiority of the Counter-Reformation over Protestant states. As much as the battle itself, then, the diffusion of information constructed the myth of a unified frontier, finally halting the Ottoman advance in the Mediterranean. Or did it? Just like Lepanto is a symbol of an outdated historiography, so this vision of the functioning of mass communication is typical of a traditional approach to the history of information. This approach places most emphasis on four elements: speed, geographical reach, quantity, mainly through the printing press, and finally, from quantity, impact, positing a direct correlation between diffusion and acceptance. It is a model that is linear and ultimately incremental. The more information, the more media, the greater the consensus. But this model doesn't work. In fact, the multiplicity of the media and the plurality of the channels meant that information at the time was dominated by contradictions and uncertainties. This is clear once we shift our point of view away from the authorities staging ceremonies and processions of Thanksgiving to the people picking up the news on the quays. There, it must have been extremely difficult to trust the earlier reports of victory. First, this is because they arrived amidst many other news of defeat, including gruesome accounts of the fall of Cyprus. Later, the multiplication of information didn't resolve the uncertainties. More news didn't mean more knowledge. The newsletters disagreed massively about even the simplest facts. More importantly, the newsletters contradicted themselves because they reflected the divisions inside the Holy League. News writers reported the unwillingness of the Christian allies to agree on a common course after the battle. And of course, that worried the authorities. It is no coincidence that both Rome and Venice prohibited the sale of manuscript newsletters for the first time at exactly this time. Focusing on the state ceremonies alone, we forget that the authorities who staged ceremonies were acutely aware of the difficulty of controlling the news. The same point applies to printed literature, as its timing suggests. Most celebratory pamphlets were published few months after the battle, just when events took a bad course on the Christian side. The Holy Alliance was disbanded, Spain turned towards Algiers, and Venice capitulated in Cyprus. In the following years, the Ottomans recaptured Tunis, and the Spanish too began making plans for peace. Situating celebratory printed texts, propaganda if you like, situating propaganda in context shows that their self-assured bellicosity was in direct proportion to the dominant defeatism. The celebrations may well have been consolatory rather than triumphalist, and probably less effective than we assume today, when that context has gone and all we have is the celebratory texts themselves. But put back in context, the notion of a bulwark constructed in information, print, and ritual against the Ottomans shows many and deep cracks. This is largely because this was no bipolar conflict. There were too many sides inside the Christian front, and each side produced its own version of the news, which then acquired different slant in different localities. There is also one side, perhaps itself divided, which I haven't covered. This is a very big elephant in this very big room. I would like to know more about the Ottoman information channels, which have only recently attracted research in languages which I can read. From what I've read, some of the analogies are striking. Ottoman chronicles show the same disagreements as Italian newsletters. With hindsight, they record the universal affliction of all Muslims, but I wonder if this is the same exaggeration of consensus that we find on the Christian side. In fact, like the Doge and the Pope, the Sultan too tried to prohibit news regarding the battle. Was information on the conquest of Cyprus constructed, so a victory that happened at the same time as the defeat at Lepanto, was information on the victory constructed in a consolatory way in the Ottoman Empire, in mirror-like fashion to what happened in Venice with Lepanto? And did the Italian newsletters also circulate back to Istanbul or to Lepanto Nafpaktos itself, where the sea had been reddened by the blood of the dead? What sort of reactions would they have prompted? Answering would require languages which I don't have. And this to me, and it's no coincidence that I started with multilingual dictionaries, because this to me is a problem in early modern global history which it's much better to admit than to ignore. However, I can suggest some hypotheses in answering my queries by turning now to my other case study, another naval battle fought nearly half a century after Lepanto, some 300 miles to the northwest in the Adriatic Sea. The Adriatic is another frontier zone in the Mediterranean, but the rivals are different. Venetians had long claimed dominion over the sea. their link to the east and a watery extension of the merchant routes to Western and Central Europe. Venice's military rule was meant to hinder competition. All foreign ships had to pay custom in Venetian ports. No foreign military vessels were allowed. Control was assured thanks to a series of fortresses along the Dalmatian coast, down from Venice to Corfu in the south. The dominion of the so-called Gulf of Venice was celebrated every year in an elaborate ritual, and as such was a central element of state ideology. But the sea had other claimants. The eastern coast was mostly in Ottoman hands, but the Ottomans made little attempt to assert themselves at sea there, and by the early 17th century were substantially at peace with the Venetians. Rivalry with Christian powers was much more troubling for Venice. First, the rise of competitors from Ancona in the papal states on the western shores. They undercut Venice by establishing direct trade with Dubrovnik at the western end of mainland routes, stretching to Istanbul. And interestingly, Dubrovnik itself was an Ottoman vassal state, something which you see recognized in Ottoman historiography, but not in Western European historiography, where the fact isn't even mentioned. Moreover, the Habsburg Archduke of Graz controlled parts of the Croatian coast and sheltered pirates who raided both Ottoman lands and Venetian convoys, pirates who constantly threatened to provoke war. For this reason, indeed, in 1615, Venice opened war against the Austrians. Finally, from southern Italy, the Spanish too became increasingly aggressive. In the early years of the century, especially under the leadership of the Duke of Osuna, who was Viceroy of Naples from 1616 to 1620. In 1617, he backed the Austrian Habsburgs by sending a fleet into the Adriatic. Spain was not at war with Venice, but so the Adriatic, as a crucial line of supply to Central Europe, just as the 30 Years' War was about to start, and as the normal, what is called the Spanish route, studied by Geoffrey Parker, was through the Alps, was closed because the Protestant Grisons had objected to the passage of Spanish troops. In 1618-19, the Viceroy of Naples, Osuna, repeatedly tried to send troops by sea to Trieste to help Emperor Ferdinand in his fight in Bohemia against Prague. Thus, control of the Adriatic came to have serious geopolitical implications on the eve of the 30 Years' War. This disrupted simple Christian-Muslim opposition. Indeed, many Venetians wrote that they hoped the Ottomans might open a second front against the Spanish. And they actually gathered information on this possibility. This wasn't just a, some kind of absurd thinking. On this background, on 19 November 1617, a large Venetian fleet led by Lorenzo Venier, the nephew of the Venetian commander at Lepanto, encountered a Spanish force in front of the island of Lesina near Dubrovnik. The actual event came to very little. The fleets essentially engaged in protracted cannon fire, but there was no actual assault and a limited number of casualties. It was in some ways a non-event, and yet, as we shall see, the battle attracted a great deal of reporting from all sides. The circulation of information turned this known event into a major one for the purposes of supporting opposite imperial claims. Venice needed a victory to reaffirm dominion of the Adriatic and gain from its strategic location, and the Spanish needed a victory to reassure their European allies that they could effectively intervene in Central Europe. The circulation of information took place on three levels. First, the contendants themselves engaged in a process of transmission and opposite manipulation of the news. On the Spanish side, the commander wrote from the battle, from sea, to the Viceroy in Naples on 21st November. He spoke ambiguously of buen suceso, good success. He underlined the enemy's numerical superiority. He boasted only a dozen casualties, but he didn't specify the damages he had inflicted to the Venetians. And he tactically retreated. He described his retreat as tactical. In effect, he was trying to portray his flight as a victory. Other sources close to the viceroy were more positive. One was a merchant from Ragusa. He supplied information to the viceroy. He described a great victory and claimed merit for pointing the Spanish to the best spot on the coast. Later, he addressed a letter directly to Philip III in Madrid, boasting the Venetian losses at 13 galleys and one galleon. On the Venetian side, a sea storm delayed the Venetian commander's letter, which reached Venice on 2 December. The commander informed the Senate that he repelled the Spaniards out of the Adriatic, but he also admitted bad news. He had failed to destroy the Spanish, in spite of his superiority, and he also announced that a storm had sunk 5 of his galleys. Like Osuna, the Venetians also had other informers. One was a spy in Brindisi, where the Spanish fleet recovered. He described the damages to the ships moored in the harbor and claimed that the Spanish fleet was broken. The Venetian representative in Naples also reported a Venetian victory. In forwarding this news, the authorities in Naples and Venice slanted them further. In writing to the king in Madrid and to colleagues around Italy, the viceroy deviated from his commander's letter. The commander said he had retreated. Osuna maintained that it was the Venetians who retreated. The commander numbered 59 Venetian vessels, Osuna 74. The commander mentioned Spanish casualties, Osuna didn't, and so on. Osuna had political motives for manipulating the news because he was at the time fighting his own battle at court back in Madrid against the Duke of Lerma, the valido of Philip III. And indeed, the Duke of Lerma's ally, the Viceroy of Sicily, passed different news to Madrid himself. From Venice, the Senate letters bore noticeable discrepancies. They assured faraway mainland governors and representatives abroad that they had beaten the Spanish out of the Adriatic. But they were less optimistic to naval commanders and governors on the coast. The Senate instructed them to prepare for further Spanish attacks. Let me make a few points on this first level of the news circulation. First, the contradictions didn't just arise between rival accounts, but within each side. The distortion of information didn't begin with public communication, as the notion of propaganda would imply, but inside the chain of command. This reminds me of a famous page of Bloch's Apologie pour l'Histoire, where he stressed that it wasn't only humble soldiers, but Napoleon himself who had a limited vision of the Battle of Austerlitz, a point which he then related to problem of possible skepticism about the value of historical evidence. Secondly, my second point, information changed as it moved because various figures actually exploited the contradictions of the reports to please their masters and advantage themselves. Uncertainty was not just a problem, it was an opportunity. Finally, information was no monopoly of public officers. The authorities did not dominate the system and instead constantly relied on multiple informers who had their own motives, like the Ragusan merchant in Naples or the obscure spy in the harbor at Brindisi. Let's now turn to a second regime of news circulation. So I'm trying to understand the time. Public dissemination. In contrast with their own uncertainties, the authorities proceeded to make self-assured official statements about the battle. Here we need to turn to the local level, because the immediate audience envisaged by the authorities was the composite urban public of Venice and Naples. To do so allows us to grasp the variety of media which the authorities used in combination. In Naples, the viceroy addressed in person the representative assembly of the richest merchants and professionals in the city, the Seggio del Popolo, which gathered in the convent of San Lorenzo. He told them that he had destroyed the entire Venetian navy and announced that Venice would no longer be able to exact fees in the Adriatic. He also ordered public festivities on the day of the conception, 3 weeks after the battle, also in San Lorenzo and in the Jesuit church of the Gesù Nuovo. Finally, he organized parades and fireworks at the Viceroyal Palace, a show of sea power, since at the time, unlike today, the Viceroyal Palace faced onto the harbor and in fact sat on top of the royal arsenal. The celebrations included a sumptuous apparatus of ephemeral arches that hailed the Duke as champion of the faith against the infidel, thus drawing on themes similar to those of Lepanto, but conflating Venetians and Ottomans. Of these, today remains only an epigraph in, not by chance, Naples, the Greek Orthodox Church in Naples. In Venice, the Senate denounced the Spanish intrusion in the Adriatic to representative assemblies on the mainland and affirmed that the enemy had been defeated. These generic reassurances were further specified when the Venetian Board of Trade convened merchants in Rialto to tell them that the Navy was safely patrolling the sea and also promised them special escorts just in case. To stress the point further, like in Naples, the Senate too ordered a ceremonial display of naval strength with a procession to the arsenal. It was lucky that two large galleons, long in the making, were ready to be baptized for the occasion. Some observers in those days commented that Venice now had a greater fleet than at the time of Lepanto. Both Venice and Spain finally also resorted to the printing press. Two news books were published within a few weeks in cheap editions aimed at a large public, in Venice, Seville, Madrid, and Malaga. They were dated only a couple of days from each other and shortly after the battle itself. Both were signed by eyewitnesses, two officers of the opposing navy, though the Venetian one, as you see, wants to remain anonymous, or the fictional officer is only given a first name anyway. To prove their authenticity, at any rate, they insisted on accounts of life aboard and on the precise location where the letters were written. That yet they contradicted each other, of course, almost point by point. They were soon followed by other pamphlets, indirectly related. In Venice, about 10 were published in 1617-18, supporting the dominion of the Adriatic. Naples was a smaller printing center, but encomiastic literature also appeared praising the viceroy, his piety, and his military records against both the Turks and the Venetians. These publications had a self-reinforcing character. In the following year, two juridical treatises referred to the two first printed reports and turned them into pieces of evidence supporting opposite legal claims. In 1618, the renowned Spanish jurist Juan Bautista Valenzuela Velázquez published a concilium in favor of freedom of the sea. The first edition appeared in Salamanca, but was immediately reprinted in Naples. On top of legal arguments, Valenzuela claimed that dominion of the sea was untenable, as showed, he said, by the Venetian defeat of the previous November. And he actually quoted the relación, the printed relación that I showed you earlier. A response came in 1619. Giulio Pace was a professor of law, born in the Republic of Venice, but a religious exile in France. He denied Valenzuela's argument as based on no evidence, sine ulla probatione. Instead, he defended the Republic's claim over the sea, de jure and de facto, as based on victories such as that of 1617, which he too recounted in detail, quoting the Venetian printed reports. Like with Lepanto in 1571, then, the authorities in both Naples and Venice tried to impose their own version of the events to underpin their opposite imperial projects. They used a wide range of media, from official declarations to ceremonial acts and print. These opposite accounts were later incorporated into the official historiography of Venice and Spain. And in fact, they have survived even today in the writing of modern military historians. But as with Lepanto, we need to question their effectiveness. So in the last 10 minutes, 15 minutes of my paper, I would like to put forward a third stage in the circulation process, one where the knowledge that was constructed was radically different from what we've seen so far. The first way of addressing this question is to reverse it, the question of the effectiveness of the message by the authorities. Why did the authorities go to such length in making public declarations, staging ceremonies, and so on? The point is that they knew their subjects had their own alternative means of obtaining information. The third and final regime of news circulation was in stark contrast with the uniformity of the authorities' official construction. First, this had to do with periodical newsletters. On reading the many available series from these years, one wonders what their readers would have made of the event. Newsletters were constantly at odds with each other. The earliest ones were vague. One affirmed that rumor has it here, qui se sparsa voce, that the fleets had an encounter with no location given. Another said that 2 of 8 Spanish galleons had sunk with little damage to ours. Numbers and details varied wildly. Another newsletter reported that the Venetians had attacked a Spanish harbor at Brindisi. The earliest newsletter from Naples reported exactly the opposite. In the following days, different news writers reported contrasting news about the timing of the battle, the size of the two fleets, the number of vessels sunk on either side, and the quantity of casualties. The contradictions of manuscript newsletters were amplified in printed pamphlets. One, in 2 different versions, came from the anti-Spanish author Giacomo Castellani, under a pseudonym, based in Turin. It was a fictional report set in Parnassus, a fashionable trope at the time. Castellani described the arrival of characters in Parnassus, a beaten and ragged Venice, and a triumphant Spain fresh from battle. This was taken from an earlier pro-Spanish pamphlet. But Castellani then fictionally unmasked these characters to show that they really were impostors. They were actors paid by Spain to cover the fact that Spain was the real loser of the battle. And as I shall explain in a moment, Castellani may have picked his theatrical argument from the streets. It's interesting, before I do that, however, I want to mention that in the fictional reports, Castellani also mentioned Spanish atrocities in the Indies. To support this, he also produced the first edition in Italian of Bartolomé de las Casas' Brevissima Relación. This is just an excerpt. A full translation came in 1626 and was published in Venice. In line with Protestant pamphleteers at the time, he brought a global theme to the service of a European polemic. Let's now switch back to the local. Given the proliferation of contrasting information, it's fair to guess that people in Venice and Naples must have received the authorities' construction with a certain degree of skepticism. This is difficult to reconstruct now, but in his diary, a Neapolitan lawyer certainly did record details about the battle which were different from those supplied by the authorities. Manuscript newsletters were only available to a minority of rich readers, but they could also fuel discussion indirectly because we know that they were read out in public, just as in this later, admittedly satirical print. And as in this print, the newsletters could prompt discussions and fights. We find evidence of this in contemporary judicial sources. In mid-December 1617, a week after the first news of the battle had reached Venice, the state inquisitors investigated in Venice a brawl, which erupted in an apothecary shop near Rialto, provoked by arguments about the battle. A merchant and a goldsmith quarreled with a lawyer who claimed that the Neapolitans sank most of Venice's galleys. The lawyer mocked the Venetians as braghessoni, an epithet common in the Commedia dell'arte's character of Pantalone, the old and impotent patrician. The three fell out and began beating each other with their sticks. Those present included the apothecary himself, a violin player, a tooth surgeon, a hat maker, and other lawyers, as well as others whose profession was so lowly that it was not recorded. These people divided along partisan lines and chose the information they wanted to believe. But there is also evidence of others who were aware of the contradictory variety of information and realized that those contradictions were the result of manipulation by various political actors. So we have here, I think, the construction of a third, radically different sort of political knowledge or savoir. An example comes from the diary of a Venetian physician. He transcribed in full and by hand the text of the printed Venetian newsbook about the battle. But he also added negative information which was absent from the newsbook and which he clearly obtained elsewhere. He praised Spanish military discipline as better than the Venetian, but he disbelieved Spanish claims of victory. He described the Viceroy of Naples, the Duke of Osuna, as gran churmadore, a great quack, who, I quote, talks in the same way as the Spanish captain does when reciting in the Commedia, and says that he will conquer Venice, and what's more, that he will do so in no time at all. This language entails a double reference. Churmadori were the quack doctors who peddled their medicines in the city square with boasts and outright lies. The word churmare meant, to quote contemporary dictionaries, to lie convincingly or to envelop someone in a web of false words. It is a pre-modern emic version of the circular movement implied in the metaphor of spinning, which is current today. The Sex Linguarum Dictionary, with which I started, translated churmare as into Spanish as vender palabras. The comparison of the Spanish viceroy and the Capitano Spagnolo is also important. The Spanish captain was a stock character in the Commedia dell'arte, vain and arrogant, full of bravados but without substance, and funny because he was chronically unable to achieve the absurd feats which he boasted. To use such language was to equate political authority to a mask and then to unmask it through ridicule. It was to respond to the construction of information with a counter-construction, a political lesson about not just the unreliability of the news, but the poverty of ideological constructions. So far, this third and final dimension I've described through local references. This is because I was keen to relate these images, which are obviously not related to the 1617 battle, to judicial records of fights and discussions that actually took place in the streets. But what about further circulation, further away? One possibility which I'd like to investigate, or someone else perhaps should investigate, is that of the itinerant movement of Commedia dell'arte troops. Commedia dell'arte actors, companies, they are wonderful subjects for a study of go-between. They spread out mostly from Italy, but moved throughout Europe. They used languages that were a mixture of their own Italian and the local vernaculars. They largely expressed themselves in gestures which needed no translation. They brought stock ideas and tropes throughout across borders. And also they mediated between very different levels of education. So this is one possibility. The other possibility is the circulation and reuses of the radical images of the Spanish captain or the quack, which I've just mentioned in other media. An example of this is the later work of Gregorio Leti. Leti was one of Italy's most prolific authors of the second half of the 17th century. He was a typical mercenary writer. Yet, as a Protestant, he had to go in exile to Geneva. He was banned there for his writings, went to Paris, again gained a position as a paid writer for Louis XIV, but then fell in disgrace. The same happened in London with Charles II, and again he was banned until he settled in Amsterdam. His work was both detested and read avidly throughout Europe. It underwent very many editions. In 1699, Leti wrote a biography of the former viceroy of Naples, the Duke of Osuna. There, the metaphor of the viceroy as a buffoonish stock character returned, as Leti described Osuna as the Spanish captain of the Commedia dell'arte. As Leti remembered, the Duke had been a skilled actor himself in his youth. And so, Leti pointed out, Osuna's bravados actually served a political purpose, to inspire fear in his enemies and subjects. This is the classic taking of the subjects by the nose, as Nodet said. But the point Leti was making was a more general one and entailed a radical alternative. The trouble was that the misconstruction of information was bound to clash with a misconstruction of the opposite kind. In 1666, 30 years before his Osuna, Gregorio Leti also published a dialogue between an ambassador and fictional characters are an ambassador and a minister of state. And the dialogue was on the use and effects of newsletters and printed gazettes. As Leti wrote there, I quote, "Everyone knows that princes turn losses into victories in order to spare the people from fear and to bring them into ever greater affection." But, Leti added, "the people always turn victories into losses, forming squadrons at their pleasure and princes to their tastes." In studying the circulation of information, we must bear in mind that different political agents and different actors could spin the news in different directions, but also that, as Leti knew, people could always spin back. Thank you.